Welcome to Soundprint. I'm Lisa Simeone. You've heard the expression, we could make beautiful music together. It must have been very poetic the first time it was uttered, even though by now it's become a cliché. For most people, it's just a metaphor. It implies that two potential romantic partners have a lot in common and would get along quite nicely. But for Margaret Leng Tan and James Grasek, it means something a bit more. 30 years ago, Margaret and James made beautiful music together as students at the Juilliard School in New York. But when their careers took them to different worlds, they lost touch. One day, they crossed paths again in Grand Central Station, and sparks, not just of a musical nature, began to fly. Producer Judith Kampfner brings us the story of the busker and the diva.
My name is James Grasek, and I play the violin. I've played at Carnegie Hall, Tully Hall, but one of my great loves, and I guess you might say career, the past many years, has been to play on the streets of New York. I play in various places. The Long Island Railroad, Grand Central Station, and then I've got the subways.
I was going to catch the train. And I'm like, I saw you. And
yeah,
I'm like,
I hope you didn't. I was yell out in the middle of it.
I'll grab a soda and I'll come back and
watch
it.
You're going to miss your train.
I can wait half an hour. So,
when I put the violin under my chin, it's to me the most natural thing to do at this point. I mean, I've been playing the violin for 35 years or more. So I just feel, even though I still have to practice, just to keep strong and to keep fit. And if I make a mistake, well, I don't even hear it sometimes because it's just a part of music making.
There's a great piece. I don't have my accompaniment with me, so I don't play it too often, but I always think of New York, hustle, bustle. And and it just has this feeling of people rushing by, you know. It's like almost like a... So when you think of New York,
I just basically call myself a musician playing in the streets, but really I am a street musician, a subway musician. The word busker can certainly be used in a very good sense, but most people who perform on the street are not necessarily as dedicated as I am, so I'm a performer.
My name is Margaret Leng Tan, and I'm a pianist and toy pianist. I work mainly in new music, even though my background was originally one of classical music. I can do just about anything that any classical pianist can do, but I'm not sure they can do what I do, which involves a whole new style of playing inside the piano, on the strings of the piano, plucking, bowing, strumming the strings. It's a whole new world that I've embarked on. So all this makes me rather special. I play new music by John Cage, the younger composers of the avant-garde. I've championed the music of Asian composers. I've been called the diva of avant-garde pianism by the New York Press. I've been referred to as the high priestess of new music. And now I'm the sorceress of the new piano. That old witch, as I call myself. I have descended from the ivory tower of classical music by playing the toy piano. The toy piano is a real toy. It's what children have in their playrooms. And the challenge of making music without compromise on a toy is not easy. I can now say there is nothing I can do on the adult piano that I cannot do on the toy piano. It was mid-November, a few days before my 75th birthday tribute to the composer George Crumb at Carnegie Hall. I was at Grand Central Terminal and decided to stop by the Oyster Bar, which is one of my favorite restaurants in New York. That is when I heard the heavenly strains of Massenet's Meditation wafting down the ramp leading to the upper concourse. I saw this figure in silhouette at the top of the ramp, a solitary figure playing the violin. And almost before I realized who it was, I knew who it was. From that beautiful, exquisite tone that he has, I knew in my heart of hearts that it was Jim Grasek playing.
When Margaret first heard me playing, she said, "Oh, Jimmy, it's you." And she told me how lovely my tone was.
I actually felt slightly awkward because I really did want to give him some money, but I didn't quite know how to do it. I didn't feel somehow that it was right for me to slip some change into his violin case. That was not appropriate. And so I was very relieved and actually delighted to find that he had several CDs available.
And she said, "I want some of your CDs." So she bought some CDs for me, and she insisted on buying some of mine for gifts.
I said to Jimmy, "Which of your CDs should I get?" And he said, "Get the Recklessly Romantic one." I said, "Okay, in that case I will, and you must write something in it for me." So he actually inscribed it to me with the following words: "Margaret, to my first love." We were genuinely, ecstatically happy to see each other. And we gave each other a really good hug. And he said, "What would you like me to play for you now?" I said, "Play me The Swan." And he did. So I just started swirling and dancing. And I remember Jim saying to me, "You still move like a dancer." I felt I shouldn't take up too much of his time. I left. And that was the end of it, as far as I was concerned. It was a beautiful, encapsulated New York vignette. 30 years have passed since we went to school. I realized how much older we both are now. And yet he's still very young at heart. He's still very good looking. He's still very lithe and trim. He hasn't gained any weight. He's not quite as blonde as he used to be, but he's still got a full head of hair. As far as I can recall, I think I first set eyes on James Grasek because he popped his head into my practice room.
I knocked on the door and there was this pianist, and it was this exotic-looking Oriental. I guess Americans have this tendency to look at the Orientals as exotic, but I didn't even know any Orientals. I didn't know him from the Orient.
And it was as if the little Polish boy in Death in Venice, which we had just been reading in literature class, had walked into my practice room.
I was attracted to her. I don't know how she felt about me.
Death in Venice is about a middle-aged man's obsession with the sheer aesthetic and physical beauty of this Polish youth. And that's the best way I can describe the way Jim looked when he was young.
She wasn't the usual look of a woman. She was quick in her body. She was this thin, and she walked fast. And she just carried on like natural. And this is what I'm attracted to. Her basic look was classy. Her basic dress was of nice material.
I think James had a very loving family. I think he came from a rather sheltered background, as so did I.
My father was a stationary engineer. He takes care of boilers, maintenance.
My father was a very prominent lawyer. I came to Juilliard when I was all of 16 years old. I came here all the way from Singapore. I went to an all-girls school and never even been on a date before I left Singapore, didn't even know any boys before I left Singapore. Coming to New York and being on my own could have been a very heady experience. I suddenly had all this freedom. But the discipline of our instruments kept us very disciplined in general.
I had the opportunity to ask her if she'd like to come out to Long Island and visit where I live. And she said yes. I was a little surprised because I hadn't asked anybody for a date to come 50 miles away.
His mother was very warm, very friendly, very welcoming. Because don't forget, in those days, there weren't too many little Oriental girls running around Juilliard. And for him to come home with this exotic creature was rather unusual, I think, in terms of a Long Island home and the suburban context in which he grew up.
I felt so at ease with her. When we got to my parents' house, we played the Mozart concerto that I was working on, the D major, and Margaret just read it right off.
I remember accompanying James on the Mozart D major violin concerto. He had a tone that was so sweet and so speaking and so from the heart that till this day I still remember how exquisite his slow movement was.
We didn't talk very much about our future. I didn't really know what I was going to do. I was confused. And I never intended to do a teaching thing. We weren't thinking about, we're going to graduate from Juilliard, just like you graduate from Yale and Harvard and you become the president of a bank. We weren't aware of what our careers could go. Margaret might have had a little more understanding.
The faculty at Juilliard pretty much thought they were grooming everybody for the concert stage, which is, of course, was an impossible dream. Juilliard is a snob institution. What would they have thought of the subway being the concert stage? They would probably have turned their noses down at it.
Most of my colleagues, or most of the people I graduated with, they have a way of life. They meet, they rehearse, they go home, and they teach. They come back and they play the concert or the ballet. And my day is completely different. Making my way on the street and playing the way I do, my association is with humanity.
In the intervening years, I got married, I got divorced. I met John Cage. My career developed. I became quite in demand for the kind of music that I played. It was fun, it was heady, it was intoxicating.
It's a great feeling when you meet somebody again after 30 years. And back at Juilliard, we had early feelings, and now we're grown-ups, and you can't forget those romantic feelings. You can't.
I really hadn't intended to see Jimmy again. But I was so taken with his playing that I really wanted to see him again. And also I wanted to get some copies of his CD to give to my friends who were getting married as wedding presents. So I went back to Grand Central and we had a lovely visit. I found this recently the other day and I thought you'd like to see it.
Beautiful. That was at Juilliard.
Yeah, that's a picture of me about 30 years ago when we were at school together.
You still look very much the same.
It was as if we could just pick up where we left off.
Give me some music.
I was just playing the Dance of the Spirits and Margaret Tunn
my friend from years ago at Juilliard. She comes by and gives me, says hello.
We went to school together.
After so many years, I found out all of what she's doing. She's famous with the toy piano and also with a great John Cage, George Crumb.
That's enough, Jimmy, stop!
Okay.
There are some wonderful pieces of new music that I'd love to introduce him to, which I think he would play very, very well and very, very beautifully. And I'm excited about that. And I do hope that we get a chance to play concerts together. It could be quite special.
Well, I'm on my way to Margaret's, and I'm looking so forward to seeing her. It's a great moment in my life to have the chance to see her and be with her again.
I tell you what, go out there, go outside, go outside. No, Oscar, you come in. Oscar's fine. Right. Jim's going to be coming to rehearsal very soon. I'm really looking forward to his being here. I've told all the dogs he's coming, and everyone's waiting at the door for him.
She brought me upstairs. There's a beautiful piano and photographs. And we got going on these Percy Grainger pieces. And it was just a good feeling, just a wonderful feeling of getting to know her again. And I felt very happy. We practiced quite a bit.
That's okay, Molly.
We're probably okay with Molly.
Margaret really likes me. And I really like her. We love each other, actually. I mean, I'm aware of the trappings of a possible affair that could lead to difficulties. You can't help yourself if you're really in love, I suppose. But if, my wife were to know about it, she'd probably think, oh, yes, that you're making up this excuse, you know, to get together for music, and you're really just, you know, doing it on the floor. I mean, I have to control it. I have to. Because I can't just up in the way, you know. I got a daughter. I got a wife who needs me. And if I don't think it would be healthy right now to just, oh, by the way, I've met somebody 30 years ago who I'm madly in love with, so long.
Jimmy has a daughter who's 17. And I realize she's just about very close to the age we were at the time. And that is a very sobering thought.
Actually, when I'm playing with Margaret, it's a feeling of connection with a beautiful person.
There is always an undercurrent.
There is a sexual energy.
Of sexual energy around Jim. There's something very, very positive in the kind of sexual energy that flows between us.
Well, yesterday I had a rehearsal with Margaret, and it was just wonderful. My wife knew that I was playing with Margaret, and she knows I play concerts with other women, too. And I did tell my wife. I said that this is a beautiful Chinese pianist that I knew at Juilliard many, many years ago, and I think she felt a little taken aback by it, but I, at the same time, she understood that I had to have this experience.
I don't feel he is someone who connives and who would deliberately use me. I'm sure Jim would like to be able to play in the subway mainly when he feels like it, but not because he has to all the time.
Do you guys hear me? No videotaping, no flash photography. So just keep an eye on it. You got it.
I don't do it out of charity to give him a leg up in his career. That's not why I'm doing it. I do it because I really do enjoy making music with him. I anticipate this concert with a certain amount of nervousness in my gut because I think my basic feeling in performing it is overshadowed by this trepidation of not letting Jim down. Percy Grainger's music is deceptively simple sounding, but the pianism involved is extremely challenging.
Tonight, with those suede shoes, with a long dress, I don't know what the word is. It, you just look like a goddess.
That's so funny.
Why? You are the sorceress of the piano.
I don't think you've heard Bridal Lullaby. So I'd just like to say a few things about the background, because it's extremely interesting. The manuscript, or a sketch of the manuscript, rather,
we gave these two concerts, one in New York City and one up in Westchester. And we our approach was pretty different.
And it was discovered by Mr. Barry Ald, who is a Grainger scholar.
For New York State School Music Association, NISMA. And a fifth grader, Muriel Mendelssohn, was playing this piece. She played with she went like... And my parents say, look at, she's wiggling her hips. So that was my memory of it. And suddenly, here I am playing it with the sorceress. So this is quite an experience for me.
I tend to ingratiate the audience, and Margaret tends to be descriptive of the music, and as somewhat of a professor would. And she reproached me for it afterwards. She kind of cut me off. I could say, oh, she wants to get moving on. But I had felt she'd done a lot of talking, and I wanted to say a few things, and I guess it just didn't seem relevant enough.
Stupid me. I just put my foot in my mouth very badly, shoved it down his throat or my throat, I'm not sure, both our throats. I made the mistake of telling him that what he did the first night wasn't exactly to my taste. And he took umbrage at this. You know, maybe I'm just a snob.
We did lock horns, you might say, and it was a bit upsetting. See, Margaret is a great prima donna, and she has her own techniques and ideas for performing. And I've been performing for so many years, so that there had to be some kind of clash in personal approach.
At this point, Jimmy takes hold of the situation and says to me, Margaret, I don't think we should play together again. I suppose music being such a central aspect to both our lives was not only a great unifier, but also a divider. And I think Jimmy was hurt deeper than I realized. Maybe if we hadn't played together, we would still have remained very, very close and intimate. But this definitely did put a wedge between us. And this collaboration precipitated the closing of that chapter of our relationship. I actually said to Jim, the buskers dumped the diva. We are out of each other's lives now, but we haven't stopped, I don't think, thinking about each other. And we keep track of each other. I very much would like to see him still make a success of his career at this point. Nothing would make me happier.
Margaret was, in my mind, the highest of dedicated and wonderful talents. And for her to tell me, oh, I love your playing, I love your sound, oh, I love it. This, to me, is the highest compliment I could get. I can be respected.
I'm traveling a great deal. It dawned on me when I was in Honolulu, and I was staying in a lovely suite of rooms with a spectacular view of the mountains, that God. Here I am, on top of the world, and there's Jim in New York, playing in the dungeons of the subway. And I thought, well, maybe our lives are really too different to be reconciled.
I do love the violin more than anything else I do. I mean, it seems a little strange to love an inanimate object. Margaret is so devoted in her way, and we're both devoted to music.
Jim loves his violin, and I love my Steinway, and I love my toy pianos. To me, they are an extension of me. They are part of my soul. Maybe we love our instruments more than we can ever love each other, because with our instruments, it's so direct, it's so uncomplicated. The relationship is there forever.
It's a beautiful song called Butterfly's Concerto or something like
oh,
that.
Oh, you mean that Chinese concerto?
Yeah.
The yellow. I know what it's called. It's called the Butterfly Lover's Concerto.
Oh, it is?
Yeah. Okay, so play that for me. Okay. Send me on my way with that.
Hi, Margaret.
Hi, Jimmy.
Good luck on your trip.
See you when I get back.
Okay.
Lots of love. Bye.
Thanks. Bye.
The Busker and the Diva was produced by Judith Kampfner. The show was mixed by Jared Weisbrot. This program originally aired as part of a special international collaboration with Radio Netherlands, funded in part by the National Endowment for the Arts. The music you heard throughout was all performed by Jimmy and or Margaret, including one performance from Margaret's archive from her Juilliard days. A lot of that music is available on CD. We have more information and links on our website, soundprint.org. You can also listen to the program online. That address again is soundprint.org. Soundprint is produced by the Soundprint Media Center in association with WAMU and American University. On the next Soundprint, Ecuadorians struggle through persecution in a Long Island village.
I said, so what'd you do? He said, well, I put my hands over my head and I got hit. And I asked him why he didn't fight back. And he said, oh, you never want to hit an Anglo. I said, well, why didn't you tell anybody? And he smiled and he looked at me and talked about being illegal.
Bean jumping, next time on Soundprint. CDs of Soundprint episodes are available for a small fee. Just call 1-888-38-TAPES to order your favorite episodes. That's 1-888-38-TAPES, or you can order online at soundprint.org. We'd like to know what you think. Your comments help us. Just send us an email. The address is talkback@soundprint.org, and don't forget to mention your local station. Soundprint is production assistant Nkechi Mogekwu and audio engineer Jared Weisbrot. Our executive producer is Moira Rankin. I'm Lisa Simeone.